Coming up today on the My Ag Life Daily News Report, we hear from a panel of climate legislation experts. We'll also have today's news brief, but we start today getting right into it with a focus on dairy. The Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Agriculture, Rural Development, Food and Drug Administration, and related agencies held a hearing Thursday titled Diversifying On-Farm Income, Opportunities to Strengthen Rural America. Much of the hearing involved dairies. Jason Weller, president of Truterra with Land O'Lakes, talked about California's greenhouse gas goals and dairy digesters.
So at Land O'Lakes, we have three primary milk sheds. So we have the Mid-Atlantic milk shed, the Upper Midwest milk shed, and we have in California our milk shed. And we have a number of dairy producers in California. And so specific to digesters, this is a story from the Land O'Lakes perspective, particularly from our dairy members' perspective, of how we can flip the script on what is traditionally a pain point, a cost center, a regulatory risk into a solution, a new revenue stream, and a way to improve the operations in the dairy farm. So overall, our dairy members in California have installed 22 dairy digesters, manure digesters, methane digesters on the farm. But part of this, there's a specific example of this of a public-private partnership I really want to emphasize here. What started out as this potentially a regulatory pinch or a real regulatory pain point, the state of California, trying to address its greenhouse gas emissions goals, has set out a goal to reduce methane emissions, methane being a very powerful greenhouse gas, from livestock manure, including dairy manure, by 40% over the next several years. So by the year 2030, they want a 40% reduction in methane emissions. So in this case, we worked with the state of California. The state of California is a great partner and has made some grant funding available to install digesters. And we worked with another private entity, the California Bioenergy LLC. So CalBio and our Land O'Lakes dairy producers are installing and building out a network, in this case, 10 methane digesters as part of this project, where it's going to be a distributed network where we're going to be capturing that methane, and then Bioenergy CalBio is going to be off-taking that gas, compressing it, enhancing the product in terms of cleansing it, and injecting that into the local utility's natural gas pipeline, where those now thermal units can now be accessed for transportation infrastructure or energy infrastructure in California. But this is beyond just renewable gas. It's improving the management of the manure on the dairy farm and creating new revenue streams, where that is now some significant revenue that's adding, helping the bottom line of our dairy members in what has been a very volatile, in some cases, stressful dairy market. But from a greenhouse gas standpoint, this project over 10 years is estimated to capture over 1.8 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent, which is the equivalent of taking off the roads of California almost 40,000 passenger vehicles every year in terms of CO2 equivalent emissions. And that's just with our 10 digesters. What unlocked this was the innovation from Land O'Lakes, innovation in terms of how we're helping our members finance it, innovative partners like California Bioenergy, and innovation in public policy and having a state partner like the state of California co-invest in this solution.
In his opening testimony, Weller talked about several issues for the dairy industry.
Good morning, Chairwoman Baldwin, Ranking Member Hoven, Senator Tester, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. My name is Jason Weller, and I serve as a member here at the Land O'Lakes Cooperative System and the lead for our sustainability business here at Land O'Lakes named Truterra. I hope I'm able to convey in the next few minutes a little bit of the passion I know I have, but also my colleagues and my coworkers at Land O'Lakes, our passion on this topic in particular, and why we're passionate in the end is because we are a farmer cooperative. So let me first just outline a little bit for the committee and for other attendees and for the audience about Land O'Lakes. So of course we are a dairy foods company, but we're more than a dairy foods company. We're actually foundationally a dairy cooperative. We're about to celebrate our 100th anniversary. We were constituted as a creamery 100 years ago in St. Paul, Minnesota. But beyond being a dairy cooperative, we're also an agricultural retail cooperative, a cooperative of cooperatives. We have over 800 ag retailer cooperatives and independent retailers who are owners and members of the Land O'Lakes family. We're also Purina. So we are the large animal nutrition business with facilities across the Midwest and across the United States, providing for nutrition and products that livestock producers need to feed their growing herds and their animals. We're also Winfield United, a crop inputs and crop insights company that provides the technologies and crop inputs that the ag retailers in turn help use to ensure a productive and profitable crop production system for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of farmers across the United States. And we're Truterra, the sustainability business, where we work with our member owners across the United States to advance both farmer sustainability and the sustainability of the supply chain. why we're passionate about this particular topic is because in the end, at the end of the day, we don't just work in rural America. Land O'Lakes is rural America. We work out of 10,000 rural communities across the United States. We have 10,000 employees that are working in rural communities. Many cases are farmers themselves. We have co-workers and colleagues that work in processing facilities and mills that during the midst of the pandemic still showed up to work, worked extra hours, notwithstanding the stress of their own concerns and impacts on our families, did it the way we know how to do, which is to roll up the sleeves and get to work and defeat a growing world. So we are approaching this concept of vitality really holistically, but also strategically. At a high level, we have three main strategies that Land O'Lakes is pursuing. So first, it's about connecting rural America. Second, it's about innovating sustainability solutions. And third, it's about building public-private partnerships to co-invest in these solutions we need on the ground. So in my testimony, I had more specific examples of the types of projects we're leading. I'm going to just very briefly highlight a few of those. So first, connecting rural America. It's, as Senator Baldwin, you had in your opening remarks, it's ensuring and really in finishing the job of connecting all Americans to the 21st century superhighway. Like the rural electrification initiatives and this interstate highway system, seeing access to the internet, whether you're in rural or urban America, is foundational, not just to be able to access a global market, but also to ensure all Americans have access to quality of life, access to education opportunities, access to business opportunities, access, of course, to educational opportunities. And that's why Land O'Lakes has partnered with over 150 organizations to launch the American Connection Project, first to advocate for sound federal policy and investments. Federal investments, over $80 billion are needed to finish the job to connect all Americans to the superhighway of the 21st century. But beyond advocacy, this coalition has also gotten to work. So just in the last year, we collectively have turned on over 3,000 Wi-Fi hotspots in rural America to allow for families to get access to telemedicine appointments, to allow for school children to get access to schooling and online learning opportunities, and frankly, just to be able to access the internet. And beyond access to the internet, we see the need to now get past advocacy also to do what we know do best, is just get to work and help advance the ball here on connectivity. Why we launched this week the American Connection Core, which is a really innovative approach I hope to be able to get to more in my remarks. Beyond connectivity, we're also innovating on sustainability solutions. So through Terra, with our ag retailer network, we're partnering with our retailers and other private sector companies and public agencies to bring conservation and stewardship solutions to thousands of farmers across the United States. And we see sustainability, conservation, in addition, as a new revenue source. So we're connecting farmers, for example, to now carbon offsets, to water quality improvement incentives, where now farmers can be compensated for the good environmental sustainability and now create new sources of income and revenue on their farms. And third and final, we're taking what has now traditionally been a waste stream and a regulatory pain point for dairy producers, their manure management, and innovating and finding new creative ways with public partners and private partners to create new sources of income, turning what is a waste stream into an income stream. That are through our barn to biogas project in California, we're now helping to convert methane into compressed renewable natural gas, powering California, but also offsetting the greenhouse gas emissions from our dairy farms. In the end, I hope to be able to convey during today's hearing is that the Land O'Lakes is not just a 100-year-old company. We see ourselves as 100 years young. We're thinking for the next 100 years. We're trying to come up with the innovative solutions we think will drive vitality, the economic, social, and environmental vitality that's needed in rural communities, of course, for the economic well-being of our member owners, but also for the well-being of these communities that we believe are foundational, not just to secure the future of America, but also to feed a growing world. Thank you very much.
Jason Weller with Land O'Lakes. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Here's your news brief for today. President Joe Biden's American Families Plan includes potential tax increases for farmers and ranchers. Michael Clements shares more on what that means for agriculture.
The American Families Plan includes some tax changes of interest to agriculture. American Farm Bureau Federation Senior Congressional Relations Director Pat Wolf says there are three changes in the bill that could mean higher taxes for farmers and ranchers.
One is an increase in the capital gains tax rate that would apply to any sale of land or buildings. The second is a curb on the ability of farmers to sell one asset and buy another without paying capital gains taxes. That's called like-kind exchanges. And the third is a new capital gains tax at death and the repeal of stepped-up basis.
Wolf says the new capital gains tax at death comes with a promise that family farmers who meet certain qualifications would be exempt. AFBF President Zippy Duvall recently spoke with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack on the issue.
AFBF President Duvall did have a conversation with USDA Secretary Vilsack about the proposed changes to tax law. And Mr. Vilsack did say that he would work to make sure that family farms across America were protected from damaging tax code changes.
Under current law, heirs inheriting farmland are allowed to increase the tax basis of the property to fair market value without paying capital gains tax.
Preserving that, which is called the stepped-up basis, as it is the best outcome for farmers and ranchers. The proposal on the table comes with the promise that farms that continue in families won't have to pay, but there's no details on how that would work. And so it's important to move with caution.
Learn more about the step-up basis at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
The Mexican Supreme Court ruled by a unanimous vote of overturning a 2017 lower court decision that blocked the importation of U.S. fresh potatoes. The ruling, which was cheered by the National Potato Council and Potatoes USA, marks the end of a decade-long legal process that began when Mexico's potato industry sued its government to prevent competition from imports. National Potato Council Vice President of Trade Affairs Jason Balcom says the ruling is consistent with Mexico's obligations under the USMCA and the WTO. He adds the ruling represents a major step forward for the industry. Since it first allowed for the importation of fresh U.S. potatoes in 2003, Mexico has restricted those potatoes to a 26-kilometer area along the U.S.-Mexico border. The restriction has violated Mexico's obligations under numerous trade agreements. In a statement, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this decision is important for American agriculture and for positive bilateral relations between the United States and Mexico. Part of the Agriculture Department's strategy to advance climate-smart agriculture was revealed recently through updates in some of its popular conservation programs. Stephanie Ho and Rod Bain look at the details of climate-smart ag within the Conservation Reserve Program, Regional Conservation Partnership Program, and others in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Earth Day 2021 featured an international climate summit convened by President Joe Biden. At USDA, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack highlighted the agency's climate mitigation efforts.
We recently announced the expansion of our CRP program, our Conservation Reserve program, looking forward to adding 4 million acres to that program. Those 4 million acres will allow us to essentially store 3.6 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent, prevent 90 million pounds of nitrogen entering into our waterways, and ensuring that 33 million tons of sediment and topsoil are preserved for productive agriculture.
He also announced a significant investment of hundreds of millions of dollars in regional conservation partnership projects.
In 45 states and over 8 critical conservation areas, this resource will help to leverage and attract an additional $400 million into these projects with a focus on drought relief, enhanced soil health, and expansion of wildlife habitat.
I'm Stephanie Ho, and in this week's Agriculture USA, my colleague Rod Bain and I will take a detailed look at some of USDA's climate mitigation efforts. How are recent changes and investments with USDA's suite of conservation programs designed to advance climate-smart agriculture and climate mitigation? Rod Bain has details.
Stephanie, producers might wonder what this advancement of Climate Smart Ag within USDA's conservation programs might look like. Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Duchenow says start with the long-running Conservation Reserve Program.
Enrollment was lagging, so we tried to envision how could we bring more folks into this. So we started to look at the voluntary nature of this program and getting producers to see themselves in that light, if you will, as a climate-smart ag producer.
That led to increasing CRP's enrollment cap from 25 to 27 million acres by the year 2023. Higher rental rates.
To increase payments for proactive incentive rates for continuous CRP from 20 to 50%. Soil rental per acre may also increase as well. That's going to be on a more case-by-case basis. We also want to increase payments for water quality practices from 10 to 20% and do this through the continuous CRP sign-up. We're also looking at establishing a CRP grassland minimum rental rate that will provide benefits to more than 1,300 counties with rates that are currently below the minimum that we're contemplating.
And new incentives, such as a climate smart practice incentive.
Establishment of trees, permanent grasses, development of wildlife habitat is hand in hand with climate smart agriculture because the more diversity you have in your ecosystem, the better your practices are for the environment on a grander scale.
Meanwhile, FSA's Companion Farm Production and Conservation Mission Area Agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, is utilizing its suite of conservation programs and public-private partnerships to build climate smart ag opportunities. NRCS Acting Chief Terry Cosby says one example is the recent $330 million investment into 85 projects under the agency's Regional Conservation Partnership Program.
When we look at the practices that NRCS has, we have in our toolbox, they contribute in a positive way to climate smart agriculture. We see a lot of those practices in the work that RCPP is going to do in these watersheds.
Climate smart agriculture is one of the priorities for project applications to be submitted for the latest round of Conservation Innovation Grant on farm trials. As NRCS Deputy Chief Jimmy Bramblett explains.
What we're trying to do with the on-farm trials portion of this is actually demonstrate how these activities, how these business practices, how these measurements of the effectiveness of conservation take place at the farm scale.
$25 million in CIG on-farm trials funding will be available to awarded proposals with the application deadline on June 21st. Back to you, Stephanie.
Secretary Vilsack says USDA is at the start of a four-year process of investing in projects and activities that take advantage of what he calls a climate opportunity.
These announcements, I think, certainly blend into the president's budget, which calls for additional resources in these areas, as well as the American Jobs Plan, a concerted effort to address the importance of climate change, to invest in climate smart agricultural practices, to create new opportunities for biofuels.
He concluded,
looking forward to continuing the conversation and discussion as we identify ways in which we can improve our capacity to meet the climate change challenge while at the same time creating new revenue and income opportunities for farmers, ranchers, and producers in a way that makes our food and agriculture industry more sustainable economically and environmentally.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Stephanie Ho with my colleague Rod Bain for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
We continue the conversation on climate and climate legislation after this.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
At the North American Agricultural Journalists Association meeting this week, we heard from a panel of experts on climate issues and climate legislation issues. Ferd Hoffner is the former policy director for the National Sustainable Ag Coalition.
You know, we did $900 billion, was it, end of last year, $1.9 trillion earlier this year. We have a $2.25 trillion proposal from the president on the table for infrastructure and climate. We have a 1.5 and growing American Families Plan just out. To paraphrase Senator Dirksen, you know, a trillion here and a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. It's kind of flabbergasting for those of us who have been in the budget wars for so long to be talking about these kinds of sums. And I guess that's my main point. This is it. This year, these bills, whether it turns out to be one or two or three or whatever, the likelihood that we get to 2023 and Congress says, oh yes, Farm Bill, go ahead and spend X amount of billions and billions of extra money is highly unlikely. This is it. This is the opportunity. We should be looking as the agriculture community as if this was the Farm Bill, because from a funding standpoint, I think it really is. So hopefully many of you saw the conservation community letter yesterday from over 130 groups calling for a doubling of the conservation budget in budget reconciliation. Or a few weeks ago, a letter from the Rural Energy for America community calling for a huge increase in funding for that program. You've got a lot of ag research proposals on the table, most recently the Durbin-Moran bill that just got introduced. All of that is in great contrast to the president's $2.25 trillion proposal, where agriculture basically gets a $1 billion placeholder. I hope that's what it is, a placeholder. I'd say rural did, you know, reasonably well, broadband, water systems, electric co-op, clean energy money, innovation hubs, community revitalization, on and on, you know, did fairly well, but ag did very poorly. At least unspecified amount of money, but at least a placeholder for investment in ag research, and some in drought mitigation. But other than that, it's just that $1 billion placeholder, nothing on conservation programs, nothing on renewable energy programs, you know, farm renewable energy programs, nothing on alternative food system, market development, supply chain resilience, any of those topics. So that's point one. Point two, I think there's multiple bills out there that point the way and become a roadmap for what we need. You know, the one that many of the organizations that I'm currently representing are most enthused about is the Agricultural Resilience Act that got reintroduced last week by Congresswoman Pingree and Senator Heinrich. It has ag research, major investments, soil health, nutrient management, major investments, farmland preservation and farm viability, pasture-based livestock management, on-farm renewable energy and food waste. I think it really catalogs a lot of what needs to happen. So it's a roadmap. It's very farmer focused. And it really importantly, I think, prioritizes investments in existing programs and structures. Doesn't try to reinvent the wheel. It does include several newer programs, primarily relies on existing ones. It sets very ambitious net zero goals in quite a bit of detail, more detail, I think, than we've seen in any other piece of legislation or even in any policy proposal. I think that's very important. It has a $50+ billion 10-year price tag. I say plus because we don't really know what the tax provisions in the bill would cost until JTC decides and tells us what the answer is. So at least $50 billion. It includes all the existing conservation programs. It includes a new soil health block grant program, which, by the way, has now been picked up almost verbatim in the new bill that Representative Rodney Davis introduced. Was that last week or the week before? Ag research, major investments in climate hubs, in long-term agroecological research, in sustainable ag research, agroforestry centers, and so on and so forth. It has grazing lands proposals, grazing lands conservation initiative, a grasslands proposal for CRP, an alternative manure management program, which would be one of the new programs in the bill. It covers renewable energy, it covers food waste, it covers tax credits for conservation easements, and a whole lot more. Another, in some ways, similar bill, though not exactly the same, is the Climate Stewardship Act, which was reintroduced several weeks earlier by Senator Booker and Representative Spanberger, who are both also co-sponsoring the Agricultural Resilience Act. That bill is far more expensive than the Agricultural Resilience Act, but covers many of the same kinds of programs, though it's not quite as comprehensive in terms of the areas it covers or in the detail of the proposal. I'd also point out Senator Durbin's, which is, I forget what it's called, America's Clean Future Fund or something like that, which is primarily a climate tax and dividend proposal, but it includes a very robust agricultural payment program that I think is worth taking a look at. And lots of individual bills. Spanberger has several. Congresswoman Brownlee, who served on the Select Committee, has a whole bunch. Representative Underwood just introduced one on conservation stewardship program. There's a bipartisan climate extension service bill that just went in the hopper last week. Several bills from House Ag Committee, Republican side, that actually take major components from the Agricultural Resilience Act and repackage them in smaller bills, which I think is a really positive sign, and so on and so forth. But I guess my main point is we've got the roadmap, we've got the existing programs, and we have the opportunity, which is budget reconciliation. You know, I think this is what it comes down to for agriculture. We either leap at this and get more than the pittance that's been offered so far, or we don't. And we don't have the tools and resources that we'll need to move agriculture towards net zero in our lifetime. So I think this is an enormous opportunity and one that we can't let go by.
Clay Pope, a rancher and member of the Oklahoma Farmers Union, talked about land use and carbon credits.
No, I appreciate the chance to come and visit a little bit. As Chris said, I did have the chance to testify on behalf of Oklahoma Farmers Union and National Farmers Union a few weeks ago to the House or to the Senate Ag Committee. You know, I do want to say, though, the opinions I expressed today are the opinions of Clay Pope. I'm not going to nail down any of the organizations that I work with. But I do think, you know, as a producer and someone who's worked in the climate area a long time, I did a stint as the executive director of the Oklahoma Association of Conservation Districts for about 10 years down here in Oklahoma. And we actually instituted a carbon program as part of our work, tying in with some of the conservation and soil health work that we did. So I've got some experience in that space. And I do some contracting work besides farming and ranching. I work with the NRCS a little bit on a contract basis to help support the work of the climate hub that's down here in the Southern Plains. And, you know, with all that together and kind of looking at where we're at right now, I think there's some real opportunities out there. But I think, like so many things in life, you know, it depends on how things are done. That old saying about how there's many a slip between the cup and the lip, I think really really is apropos in this discussion right now. Because, you know, I think, as was mentioned earlier about the pieces of legislation that are floating around out there, the dollars that are being kicked around, I do think there's once in a lifetime opportunity right now to really make a difference. And make a difference not just for helping the environment, but also helping farmers and ranchers better prepare for the extreme weather events that climate change is exacerbating. I could go through the whole list and tick everything off as far as the challenges that we're seeing and how the crazy weather, especially in my part of the world, we've always had, it's kind of been shot full of steroids. Now the 100-year floods, now the 50-year flood, and the 50-year flood's just a bad spring storm. And bottom line, something's going on and there is an opportunity, but I think the challenge is how we do it. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that I want to talk a little bit about now is the approach that we take and how we try to morph something to help producers move forward. You know, as was mentioned earlier, there's some opportunities for funds. And I know there's a lot of things being kicked around. If you're in Germany, you know, get your whiskey ready or your beer, because, you know, obviously Carbon Bank, the CCC, the idea of the marketplace coming in and helping to support some of this activity, I think provides some opportunities for agriculture producers. At the same time, though, I think there's a lot of challenges involved with that. You know, but the first thing that I would say is whatever we do from a policy standpoint, we've got to make sure that we recognize the early adopters that are out there. You know, there's many producers that for, you know, in many cases, decades have been working on some of these things that now fall underneath that regenerative agriculture, umbrella, which has kind of become the cause du jour to help agriculture deal with climate change, both from an adaptation and mitigation standpoint. But when you start talking about market-based solutions, so many times the question of additionality, you know, we want to pay for new practices. We don't want to pay for what's been going on. I can think of no bigger policy mistake that can be made by the federal government than to shut the door or to leave those early adopters, those soil health champions, those individuals who have been pioneering the way in some of these practices. A lot of times, quite frankly, in a little bit of an opposition position to farm programs and also advice that they're getting from land grant universities, guys that have kind of led the way on this stuff. We've got to make sure that they've got a seat at the table because for two reasons. One, it would be horrible to leave those guys out and not recognize the good work that they're doing. But also, you know, all of a sudden now the natural base of support, not only for what's being done right now, but to move these concepts forward. Now, all of a sudden you put a real damper on their ardor for what we're trying to do to try to address some of these challenges. So I think that has to be addressed. I think we also need to think beyond just carbon sequestration and avoided emissions. I mentioned the good work that those early adopters are doing. I think one of the things that a lot of people lose sight of is that depending on where you're at, it's going to depend on how much carbon you can sequester. And when you think about, I do a lot of work down here in the Southern Plains, which means I do a lot of work down in the Golden Spread area of cotton producers down in West Texas. And there's guys that are doing outstanding stewardship work. They've minimized or eliminated tillage. They're doing cover crops. They've incorporated livestock. They're doing everything that we want them to do. But at the end of the day, it's going to take them a hell of a long time to build organic matter because they're farming in the middle of the desert. Now, they just can't sequester carbon at the rate of, say, someone in Iowa that's a corn and bean producer that converts to no-till and starts incorporating cover crops because of where they're at. But at the same time, that producer down there in that area is not just avoiding emissions because obviously they're burning less diesel and they are sequestering some carbon, but they're also controlling erosion. They're also addressing water quality issues, water quantity issues. And when you think about the life of the aquifer down in that area, that's a huge environmental challenge. And that's also something that's tied up in climate change. Water availability is a challenge when you start talking about droughts and floods. So we've got to recognize the multiple benefits that are generated by these activities. And then the other thing that I'd throw out there is you've got to have a program that's farmer friendly. I'd mentioned the fact that I'd worked in Oklahoma for the conservation districts and we had a carbon program. One of the things that we did in Oklahoma, and we actually had over 50,000 acres one time in under contract in Oklahoma for a carbon sequestration program. We set it up where our state conservation agency could verify carbon credits on behalf of the state of Oklahoma. We did that really as another form of technical assistance for those farmers and ranchers. And I think the federal government needs to think about that because right now when you start talking about market-based solutions, it's a wild west. I mean, it's all over the place. And concern that I have is you're going to have all this stuff all over the map, and then you're going to run into a situation where a farmer or rancher undertakes practices, wants to sell a carbon credit, is going to cost them $9.50 to verify a $10 credit. That's a concern, because if it doesn't make economic sense, if it's too overly complicated, a lot of producers are just going to throw their hands up and walk away. And again, you're not going to get the bang for your buck for what you're trying to do with your program. So I think that's the big three things as we move forward on the policy side: making sure we're taking care of early adopters, recognize the bundled benefits that come from the practices that fall into that carbon sequestration program, and then also the issue of trying to make it farmer friendly. And I think having a public sector verification system for agriculture producers so that they can get a base credit that they can work with in the private market. space. Now, beyond that, as we talk about some of the issues that are out there, was mentioned the infrastructure bill. I think there needs to be a recognition, again, going back to that bundled benefits, that there's other opportunities just outside of the farm bill to help folks address some of these issues. I see all this discussion of water and water quality. I mentioned that carbon credit program in Oklahoma again, because a lot of the acres that were enrolled underneath that credit were also participants in what's called the EPA 319 program, which is a non-point source pollution program that in Oklahoma actually is under the control of our state conservation agency. They basically turn it into another cost share program. NRCS and FSA partner with them as far as making it an equal priority area, and when applicable, doing a CREP program. Those guys are doing the things to help address water quality, which 9 times out of 10 are the same things that you want them to do to help address climate change. You know, you're talking about converting to no-till, taking highly erodible land out of production, putting it back to grass and doing better pasture management, incorporating cover crops, restoring riparian restoration, doing those things that help address non-point source pollution, but they also have a sequestration value. When you look at this infrastructure bill, I think it would do our policymakers well and the administration well to look at how you can push programs like EPA 319. Like the water and wastewater programs underneath USDA rural development, like the Safe Drinking Water Act revolving funds, that the money that goes out to the states. How can we use those programs to get more bang for our buck again? How can we encourage them that when applicable, it doesn't work everywhere, but if you have a situation where a town has water quality problems, can you work with the producers in the watershed above that reservoir to implement some of these practices to address that problem? And at the same time, help address climate change, both from a mitigation standpoint and also helping those producers adapt to those extreme weather events. Because again, the same things that we want to do 9 times out of 10 is do things like control soil erosion, increase water holding capacity. Those are the same things that also control runoff. They're also the same things that increase carbon sequestration and the same things that reduce diesel use. So, I mean, I think we need to think about that a little bit as we discuss some of these policies about how you can tie this stuff together. And I think that kind of feeds into this idea of a carbon bank and trying to get something started. I'm all for carbon credits. I don't want anybody to misunderstand that. I'm for carbon credits. I think it's great if we can find private sector solutions and we can have market-based incentives to help with this. But we've got to recognize some of the challenges that we're going to have with that, starting first, again, with those early adopters, and how you make sure they have a seat at the table. Moving on beyond that, as I mentioned, trying to do something on the private or on the public side on verification, I think it's important that we have additional money for conservation technical assistance at NRCS or folks in those offices that can help not just in trying to verify some of this stuff and doing some of the things I want to do that's new, but also with basic conservation assistance to producers to help them better prepare for the extreme weather events that climate change is exacerbating. We already have a lot of tools in our toolkit at USDA to help address this. I think we've got to make sure we've got the people that can help producers do that and that they in turn understand how some of these programs can be, how they're applicable to help producers deal with some of these challenges, which then converts over, it was mentioned earlier, the climate hubs. I think there's a real role for the hubs to help with that as far as educating you, not just agriculture producers themselves, but also USDA employees about how the programs that are already out there, the arrows we've already got in our quiver, so to speak, can be sharpened up a little bit better and shot at this monster, climate change, that to help producers deal with some of these challenges ahead of them. And I think that's something that we need to be mindful of too, because I think guys who work in the USDA service centers are products of rural America, just like cooperators that they're working with. And they've got that same hesitancy, that same challenge, challenge. That's probably the best one I can come up with. When you talk about climate change, understanding it and understanding how to work on the issue. So, I mean, I think that's something we need to think about. I'd also throw out there kind of in that same vein, I think it would be helpful for USDA to take a look at what's already going on. USDA has put significant money into things like Comet Planner and Comet Farm. Let's use that to plug that in to what we've done with conservation programs since the 2018 Farm Bill.
We have more from the climate panel right after this.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
My Ag Life, calendar of events. Here's Taylor Chalstrom with what's happening around the state.
On May 4th, we have pesticide safety webinar series, Rodenticides and Wildlife, as well as a virtual regional workshop in the North Coast region. On May 5th, we have 2021 UC Cooperative Extension Tree and Vine IPM Breakfast Meeting, Cherry Buckskin. And on May 6th, we have a continuing education webinar for laws and regulation updates for paraquat label changes, as well as another continuing education webinar for pest ID, pest life cycles, and IPM. Check out those events and more at myaglife.com. And don't forget that registration is now open for the 2021 Almond Day, hosted by West Coast Nut on June 15th, 2021. It's going to be a virtual event with CEU credits offered.
Get more details at myaglife.com.
We continue now with the climate panel from this week's NAAJ meeting. Here's Deb Reed, the Executive Director of the Ecosystem Services Market Consortium, or ESMC.
Thanks for inviting me, and I really appreciate both Ferd and Clay's comments, and I think I can build off them and add to it. So ESMC is a nonprofit public-private partnership, and we have over 70 members across the agricultural supply chain and value chain, including grower groups, food companies, food and beverage companies, land-grant universities, and federal and state agencies, and others, ag tech companies, really working on investing in a national scale, standardized, harmonized market for agricultural credits. Our theory of change is that we are seeing, as you've heard from this discussion, both lots of demand for greenhouse gas mitigation and other societal benefits from agriculture, and lots of opportunities as well. And our theory of change is that we can utilize markets as one of the tools in our toolbox to help scale beneficial outcomes from agriculture. So we, ESMC, are really an enabling environment and creating a national scale program so that both buyers and sellers who are interested in working in a market context can meet their needs, increase their ambition, build their ambition, and meet the commitments and obligations they have and the societal demand in a way that farmers and ranchers are being recognized and rewarded and paid for what their role is in this, because they are the ones actually creating these benefits. So we create and generate credits for soil carbon increases, as well as greenhouse gas emission reductions, water quality credits, water quantity credits, and we're starting to work on biodiversity. And that is, again, all by demand. And what we are doing is ensuring that we have the infrastructure at a national scale to quantify, to verify credits, which are really intangible credits, so that we can ensure the credibility, the veracity of those credits, if you will. And again, really reward farmers and ranchers. Because we're a public-private partnership, we are spending a lot of time thinking about and advocating for what is the proper federal role, what is the private sector role. And I will say that the private sector has really been doing a lot in this space and investing in ways to not only reduce their own, whether it's a corporate greenhouse gas footprint or water footprint, but reduce the footprint of the supply chain, particularly in agricultural supply chain. And so we're, again, an enabling environment, creating the tools, the opportunities to ensure that we can do that and do that following market standards. There's also lots of things that the federal government can do. I will point out, Clay, to your point, markets, like any commodity market, pay for product and pay for new product. That is why market and the demand signal for early adopters does not exist. Markets pay for new product, and there's reason for that. We don't need to go into that. But I do think that's an excellent opportunity for the federal government to actually reward farmers and ranchers who have done things in the past through early adoption, given that there's both a federal requirement and need to reduce greenhouse gases, as well as what the private sector is doing. So if we think about the public role, the private role, perfect opportunity for the federal government, for state governments to pay for early adopters. The private governments will pay for the new product. And then together, I think we can offer solutions. I think that another point to make is that we are seeing huge demand, and Ferd spoke to all of the money now focused on agriculture as a natural climate solution, right? And that's because there's not just demand, but there's a huge opportunity set, and there's a lot of money being put on the table. And thinking about the public role, the private role, and how we leverage each other's resources is, again, a lot of what we're doing within ESMC. We view, for instance, conservation programs as a really necessary stepping stone to potential participation in markets. Federal USDA conservation programs, for instance, provide a form of upfront financing for ranchers and farmers to undertake some of the systems changes that you can then turn into credits and sell in these private markets, right? So there's, I think, just lots of opportunity for us to work together and achieve climate solutions from agriculture in a way that works best for farmers and ranchers on the ground. Clay also talked a lot about the need for verification. And it's important in markets that, again, these credits are really intangible. So it's important that we're quantifying them, but also verifying them to market standards. And alluded to the Growing Climate Solutions Act that the Senate has passed, and for which there's, I think, a lot of momentum and a lot of opportunity. And that act would actually create another enabling environment for private markets by ensuring that USDA can certify technical assistance providers who understand the markets, how they operate, and can enable farmers and ranchers to enroll in the markets and get the most value for themselves. And then it would also certify verifiers who can operate in those markets according to market standards. And that's important because in markets right now, there's not a lot of expertise for agricultural verifiers. We do need those verifiers who understand agriculture. What is happening right now is we typically get a verifier who's a forestry expert that does not understand agriculture. It increases the cost of verification for a lot of reasons. So I think that bill, the Growing Climate Solutions Act, really offers some opportunities to use some federal funds to create some opportunities to enable farmers and ranchers to participate in those private markets and really just create additional value to what they may be able to get through other conservation programs, et cetera. So I just think that we are really at the start of seeing a huge opportunity set for agriculture. It will continue to go up, and we really just need to ensure that farmers and ranchers have the tools and the opportunities to benefit, whether it's markets or other federal programs.
Randy Russell, the principal of the Russell Group, representing the Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance, also gave an update.
I want to thank all of you in the ag journalism business. Thanks for what you do each and every day to report on our great industry and to keep us informed and to educate people. We may not always agree, but your role is critical to helping inform all of us and the people we work with on what's going on in the agriculture and food industry. So thanks. I wanted to give you a quick update on where we are with the Food and Agricultural Climate Alliance. I would, like Clay, probably not like to be in a position to necessarily say that I am the spokesperson for our group because we got a lot of great members. But I'll give you a quick update as to where we are and where we think this debate is all going. As you know, we started this Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance back in late in 2019. We had no idea who the next president was going to be. We had no idea who was going to control the Senate and the House. This was not really driven by politics. It was really driven by the fact that back in 2009, when we did cap and trade, and that fell apart for a lot of obvious reasons. But when that did occur, folks in the ag industry realized we didn't have a seat at the table. And a lot has changed since 2009 in terms of people's view, as Clay cited, Debbie inferred, towards this whole climate debate. And agriculture, forestry, the environmental community, conservation community, food industry wanted to have a seat at the table. And that was really kind of the guiding principle that brought us all together. We now stand at about 70 organizations that are members of the Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance. We have 24 steering committee members. And let me give you a quick update on where we are on a couple of important topics. First of all, obviously we had over 40 recommendations that we put out last fall. And two areas that we have spent an enormous amount of time and have had working groups. One is on the incentives side, and that includes our tax credit recommendations. And we're getting very granular now in terms of what those will look like. So you'll hear more about that in the days and weeks to come. And then as Clay alluded to, we've also spent a lot of time on the carbon bank. And given some of USDA's activity on that, what would we recommend from our members as to what that carbon bank should look like and what it shouldn't look like? And if I'm a betting person, I would suspect you're going to see more out of FACA relative to those recommendations here in the coming week or so. Let me also just talk for a second about the Growing Climate Solutions Act that Deb just referred to. We obviously endorse that. And look, there's really two things about the Growing Climate Solutions Act that is important. And the first is that I want to reiterate something I think that Deb made a great point. And that is that if we are going to foster the growth of private markets in this whole carbon and carbon equivalent space, then we have to have certified technical service providers and others that clearly can go out and measure and verify the credits that are generated. And that is critically important. And that is a big part of what the Growing Climate Solutions Act does. We strongly endorse it. And let me tell you, as I don't have to tell you folks that watch the Senate and the House these days, anytime you can get over 40 members, evenly split House and Senate, to support something coming out of committee, that's a rarity. I mean, as we look at Mother's Day coming up a week from Sunday, it's hard to think that we could get that many members to support a Mother's Day resolution. So I tip my hat to Senators Braun and Stabenow and the others that have come out and endorsed that, that legislation. Second of all, I would say that it takes outsized importance, even beyond the important substantive part of the Growing Climate Solutions Act. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that it shows that on this very important climate issue, that Democrats and Republicans in the Senate can come together in the ag community and endorse an important first step climate legislation and try to get it passed in the Senate. And I think that's critically important in a very evenly divided Congress that is very partisan right now. For the ag community to come together and endorse this and get it out of committee in such a bipartisan fashion, I think it helps pave the way as we get into other issues such as incentives and other things that Ferd and Clay and Deb have talked about. Finally, let me just cite the fact that before we get to questions and turn it back over to Chris, that you know a lot has changed since 2009. In terms of where we are, not only on measurement and verification, but people's view towards the whole issue of climate. Let me start first with consumers. There is a recent survey out that said that 70% of consumers, 40 and under, were willing to pay more for food if it could be shown that it was produced in a climate-friendly manner. So the consumer marketplace is clearly changing. What about investors? Well, we've got now we have a Dow Jones Industrial Sustainability Index. was started in 1999. It has 40 companies in it from the United States, but 238 globally. And just last year, there was a 19% increase in companies' participation in this index. So clearly the investment community is looking very closely at climate and sustainability. And then Clay talked about this at the farm level, what's going on. There was a poll, an Iowa farm poll done with the Iowa State University last year. And it cited that in 2020, 81% of farmers believe climate change is occurring. That was up from 65% 10 years earlier. And 50% of them said that they are concerned about climate effects on their own farming operation. And that's up from 35% in 2011. And then finally, political. Look, a lot of Democrats have been there on climate. I think where the big change has come over the last 5, 6, 7 years are with Republicans. I'm not suggesting there still isn't some skepticism, because there is. But I do think if you look at a recent Pew poll that came out, there it stated that or showed that 40 for Republicans under the age of 40, 52% of them felt that the government was doing too little on climate. 46% of Republican women felt like the government was doing too little on climate. 65% of moderate Republicans and independent said the government was doing too little on climate. So my point here is that things are changing. Things are changing at the marketplace, consumer marketplace. It's certainly changing in the investment community. Farmers' attitudes towards climate has changed because of what they're seeing in terms of climate variability. And even in the Republican Democratic circles, we're seeing changes about this important issue.
I would love to hear your thoughts on these climate issues. You can email me anytime at sabrina@myaglife.com. That is our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.